Today's program was brought to you by Bonnie Plants, bonnieplants.com.
I'm Linda Palaccio, host of A Taste of the Past. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to the Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkel. Today with Anna Jones.
Either way, it's great. Anna Jones.
I think it's the American English way as well. I'm just terrible with names, but I do know a modern way to eat. And I've been so smitten with this, not because I had so many parallels to your story. What's funny is your book is about almost a trial of vegetarianism that completely converted you into what you are today, into this mode of thought, but also elevating a cuisine that was once kind of, can I say shitty?
Yeah, I think that's fair.
Yeah, I know in the U.S. you'd go to a restaurant and they say, oh, our vegetarian entree is some kind of pasta covered in cheese and some steamed vegetables on the side. Yeah. What was that like in the U.K.?
It sounds pretty similar. It sounds a pretty similar experience, to be honest. There was a lot of cheesy mushroom sort of scenarios, a lot of risottos that didn't have much love. You know, if you were really lucky, you might get sort of a couscous stuffed pepper, but I mean, that was pretty out there. So yeah, I think it was very much the same experience. If you were a chef and you were trying to cook for vegetarians, it was either throw a lot of dairy and cheese at the problem or a lot of carbs.
Yeah. So growing up in the UK, it's funny, having April Bloomfield on the last show, we already kind of talked about the preconcepts of what British cuisine is. Yeah. Were there preconcepts in your household, or were you outside of that box?
No, they definitely were. And it's funny, me and April are both from Birmingham, both good Brummie girls. I'm sure that we had a reasonably similar sort of upbringing. I know she was talking about salad sandwiches and Heinz salad cream, and that's definitely something that I associate with. I sort of always say that I grew up in a sort of standard meat and two veg family, really, where, you know, dinner was potatoes, a vegetable, and, you know, really a bit of meat. So, yeah, that was what I experienced, and that was... Yeah.
I mean, that was kind of the older way of thinking and cooking at that time. But your mother was a little bit more modern in how she adapted food, to your meals. Talk about that.
Yeah, she was. I think my mom grew up in the 60s and 70s, and she was sort of a pretty liberal modern woman, and I guess a bit of a feminist, you'd say. I think for her, she felt like cooking was a bit of an infringement on her liberty and her kind of, you know, power as a woman. She didn't want to be cooking the dinner every night. So cooking for me was something that I learned, really. Mum always gave us healthy food. She was, you know, down the health food shop all the time and trying to persuade us to eat, you know, sugar-free jams instead of normal jams. So she definitely had that in mind. But there was never that kind of long, languid kind of enjoyment of cooking, which is something that, you know, I definitely have sort of engaged with at a pretty early age.
Yeah, I'd like to talk about that empowerment. Being a woman in an industry that was primarily men and still is primarily men, what made you want to go into that workforce?
greed, maybe. I've always loved eating. I've always been pretty greedy, and I always wanted to learn how to cook stuff myself. I think before, you know, when you're younger and your diet is perhaps under the control of your parents, I knew that the only way for me to kind of have the things I loved, be it chocolate mousse or a cupcake or whatever else, was for me to make them myself. Because if I'd made them, Mum and Dad would be like, oh yeah, sure, have those. So I think that was my way of kind of sort of investigating food, I guess a little bit. And I think it was just a pure passion for food that led me into it. I never thought about whether it was a male or a female dominated industry. And I think the passion for food came much earlier on. I don't think I ever considered a career as a chef or a career as a cook. I came through quite a sort of academic kind of route. And, you know, when I sort of encouraged my teachers to ask if I could do something a bit more creative, they told me, why don't I give economics a try?
And economics didn't mean numbers. Economics was in the kitchen, and it was almost housewifey, yes?
Oh, no. I mean economics.
Oh,
numbers.
Okay, like, yeah. It's not home economics. Yeah, no. It's worldly economics.
Yeah, they thought that was like the creative side of learning, which I'm sure economics can be creative, but definitely it wasn't the creativity I was after.
So where did you find yourself with that spark of creativity in the kitchen prior to going into other restaurants?
I kind of made a jump, I guess, when I was about sort of 24. I was working in a job that I kind of didn't really connect with, and I'm quite good in that I have a sort of quite useful characteristic. When I'm not engaged in something, I am incredibly, incredibly lazy. So I was just drifting and knew that there was, you know, no way I could continue like that. So I read an article once in the Sunday paper that said, you know, you determine your calling by which bit of the Sunday paper you turn to first. And for me, it was always the restaurant section. And, you know, this kind of spark went off in my head. And I knew then that was kind of my creative force. And that kind of little girl who'd been making chocolate mousses and cupcakes had kind of been ignored. So that was, I guess, the moment when I reconnected with that and reconnected with that creativity.
Who was Jamie Oliver at that point in your life?
So he was just a guy who was on TV telling a lot of bad jokes.
Yeah, he's still the naked chef, right?
He was still the naked chef. And whilst I kind of love what he was doing with cooking, you know, he was really boisy, and he was always out with all of his mates. And, you know, he wasn't the kind of incredibly cool and, you know, pioneering guy that he is now. So yeah, I actually connected with him and enrolled on his cooking course at 15, which is an amazing restaurant in London. So for me, he was kind of, I guess, he became my mentor and my boss, really, for the next 7 or 8 years.
And in that cooking, well, it was called training program, correct?
Yeah.
During that time, what did you learn and where did you go from there?
Well, I learned a huge amount. I have to say, I don't think there's any amount of money in the world that could buy a cooking course like that. It was like cooking on fast forward, and it was at an amazing time when Jamie's business and profile was kind of just blossoming, so kind of everyone wanted a piece of him. So we were taken to the sort of, you know, Chianti vineyards and being given bottles of wine that we had absolutely no right to be drinking. We were, you know, sort of seeing the first green grassy olive oil coming off the presses. The chefs just had an absolute free rein in the restaurant to order exactly what they wanted. And it was, you know, it was just a bunch of friends really cooking together. So it was an incredible time.
I mean, you talk about creativity, and to be at a point of such inquiry, you know, having minds that want to know more and want to do more with what's around them. I mean, you couldn't have moved to a better field at a better time.
No, I think it was really the turning point, I think, especially in London for food. You know, the restaurant scene now compared to sort of, you know, 10 or 11 years ago when I started cooking is utterly unrecognizable. You know, I know you were speaking to April Bloomfield when you spoke to her last week about, you know, how British food has had such a bad write-up. And I think the last 10 years have been just so pivotal in that change. But yeah, it was an incredibly exciting time to be working in food.
And for, I think, what, the last 7 out of 10-ish years. Mm-hmm. You were still working with Jamie, but under another capacity. You weren't necessarily in the kitchen all the time, but more on the creative side of things.
Yeah, absolutely. I was kind of working on his personal creative team, so helping him with anything he did to do with food, be it commercials, be it kind of cookery books, be it developing recipes. And, you know, the work that I really loved and connected with was, you know, a lot of his campaign work, the amazing work he did, you know, with the school dinners campaign in the UK and then over here, and, you know, campaigns about sort of provenance of meat and chicken and eggs. So yeah, it was a real education in kind of both sides of the food world, because whilst I was, you know, sort of poncing around with lettuce leaves making, you know, pictures look really pretty for books, I was also going into sort of, you know, families' houses where they were feeding their kids, you know, just chips every night of the week. And chips, I mean fries, sorry. Mm-hmm. every night of the week, you know, and actually trying to sort of persuade them to eat asparagus. So it was kind of real top to bottom stuff.
I mean, but you weren't going in there with your styling tricks and putting asparagus creative way on the plate. You were trying to educate them.
Absolutely, yeah, yeah. And my job during that time is really to be sort of Jamie's food eyes and ears. So, you know, his schedule obviously has kind of got crazier and crazier. So when he couldn't be around and he couldn't engage with the people that, you know, he really wanted to help, that was kind of my role.
So, you know, what's funny is again, I did the same thing as you, went vegetarian, mm-hmm. kind of as a trial, and forgot, mm-hmm. or kind of even more so challenged myself to keep being vegetarian.
Yeah.
When did you do that? Because you didn't tell anybody at first.
No, I didn't tell anyone. Mainly because I was in the company of a lot of chefs who at the time thought that cooking kind of trotters and snouts was, I mean, the ultimate possible thing that you could do. It was when St. John's in London was, you know, the kind of go-to restaurant, and that's Fergus Henderson's amazing nose-to-tail restaurant. So, yeah, it just... When I thought of telling someone I was vegetarian, it just felt like I was, you know, committing a terrible, terrible culinary crime against the world, you know. So I kind of kept it under wraps for a bit because I wanted people to know about the food I was cooking from tasting it rather than from the rhetoric and the kind of, you know, there's a worthiness attached to the word vegetarian, which I just think needs to be shaken off.
Yeah. So, I mean, in becoming a vegetarian, did you already have go-to dishes that you had cooked your whole life that were vegetarian, or were they dishes that you converted from, this is a meat dish now made to be a vegetarian?
Yeah, I guess there's always been, like, vegetarian dishes in my life. I grew up, you know, I started my culinary career learning about Italian food, and the Italians are, you know, incredible with vegetables. I spent quite a few years in the kind of Chianti fields in Tuscany cooking there. So, yeah, that side of things I kind of always knew. But I think when I stopped kind of putting meat and fish at the center of the plate, my whole world of cooking opened up. I there was more of a fluidity to what I was making. I was cooking based around sort of seasons, based around moods, based around how I was feeling, based around the kind of type of cuisine I wanted, rather than, you know, the piece of meat I had in the fridge that, you know, I knew I had to use before tomorrow. So it became much more creative, and I think that is what has kept me really engaged in sort of a vegetable centered way of eating.
Yeah, and you had such a great community, because at that time you got to collaborate with the likes of Yotam Ottolenghi, Sophie Dahl, and the fabulous Baker brothers, because they too kind of looked towards vegetarianism or vegetable based dishes as a way to highlight you know, the bounty of the surrounding areas, but also their skills as cooks.
Absolutely, yeah. And I think Yotam Ottolenghi is just such an incredible example of someone who's putting vegetables at the forefront, and flavor and layering and that kind of really important salty, sweet, sour, bitter kind of, you know, flavor profile right at the front of his cooking. And, you know, no one really noticed that his vegetarian book Plenty was in fact vegetarian. And I think that's what's always been really important to me in my work, and in, you know, the book we're talking about is that I wanted people to get sort of 75% of the way through and be like, hey, I don't think I've seen like a meat or fish recipe here. I wanted it to feel generous, you know, visually as well.
Well, can I want to read your promises, and I'm hoping you stuck to these things too.
Yeah. Be embarrassing if I haven't.
Yeah. But if you read these aloud, I hope you do this as well, and realize that your ideology hasn't kind of gone adrift. And that this holds true for both vegetarians, even vegans, as well as omnivores and carnivores. And if you didn't know, there's no mention of what dishes we're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
But here it goes. Your promises are it can still be indulgent and delicious, make you feel good and look good, leave you feeling light yet satisfied, help lighten the footprint on the planet, quick and won't cost the earth, and it can still impress your friends and family. Again, without knowing that this book is vegetarian and reading those things, you would never make that assumption. But if you did know it was vegetarian, you would never expect those things.
Yeah, I think so. I think that, you know, for too long, kind of vegetable-centered food has kind of, especially in the UK, I think you guys, you know, as always, or over here in the States, are a few years ahead of us. But, you know, for too long in the UK, it was the kind of territory of kind of, you know, weird kind of hemp trousers and mung beans and, you know, sort of pink and yellow painted cafes. Yeah, I think, you know, it is okay to make, and it is real and honest to make those promises about food. And I think that's why people, you know, haven't ventured into making vegetables the center of their meals, you know, much more often, because they are scared of leaving the table, you know, still starving hungry, you know, or they are, you know, scared that they're going to have to go out and buy 50 million weird ingredients. And that just doesn't have to be the case.
Well, two things. One, when you said hemp and mung beans, it sounded like the lyric to some wonderful British mod song I didn't know about.
It should be one.
Absolutely. But what I love about this book is, you know, there are a couple quick little things that you can, you know, start kind of putting into your repertoire, like replacing nut butters for butters and cookies, using coconut oil for buttering toast, adding quinoa millet to morning oatmeals.
Mm-hmm.
That are just, you know, slight, they're entry points,
yeah,
into the grander scheme of what a modern way to eat means to you. But then the best thing about this is often you read an introduction, often you see recipes and head notes, but there's not the tutorial or almost infographic that you give on how to build a recipe. And can you tell me what it's like to be in the mind of a chef or be creative in that way and strip away the intimidation of what it means to put a recipe together?
Yeah, sure. Well, I felt that was really important when I was writing the book, that it was beyond, you know, just sort of really prescriptive recipes, because some nights you just don't have, you know, the right things in the cupboard and you want to just do something yourself. So I always think about how I put a recipe together, I often think about my brother, who's a musician, and I think about how we hear a song in two completely different ways. He kind of, I'll just hear a melody, I might strain and hear a drum beat, you know, I might be able to hear the bass line if I'm really trying, whereas he'll, you know, there will be 100 different things he hears in just the guitar, you know, it will be the distortion, the amp, you know, the feedback, maybe even the type of guitar. And I think that some people's brains are wired for food and some people's brains aren't, and that's kind of what I tried to communicate in all of these infographics, is how I go about building a dish and how that kind of change in creativity when I sort of took the normal building blocks away changed how I cook. So I guess usually I start off with you know, a vegetable or what I want to be the hero, as I call it, or the main event. So that could be something like butternut squash. Then I'll think, right, okay, well, what do I want to go with that? Maybe I want kind of like a backup flavor, whether that's kind of some spinach, or, you know, whether that might be, you know, another vegetable, like some, you know, beautiful baby leeks or something like that. Then I'll kind of think about how the dish is going to feel from a sort of satisfaction point of view. So, you know, I'll try and put some kind of protein in there, or I'll put a grain or some pulses, or, you know, even some torn up bread. you know, possibly, you know, some kind of being heard or something like that. And then I'll think about, you know, that's the kind of nuts and bolts there. And then I'll think about layering up the flavors. So I cook with loads of lemon. I think, you know, I use it as a seasoning, really, just as much as I would salt. So then I'll think about the citrus notes. I'll think about the spices and how I kind of build those. And then going on from that, you know, I'll think about kind of, you know, the sweetness, if there needs to be any sweetness, if there needs to be any sharpness, you know, if there needs to be vinegar or anything, you know, slightly bitter like radicchio. And I'll just try and make a kind of visual map of this dish in my head. And then once I'm happy that all of those things are going to balance out, I'll think about texture. I'll think about, you know, what is that going to feel like to eat? How am I going to be sated by, you know, on a textural level as well? So if the butternut squash is quite soft, you know, but I've got some pearl barley in there, I know that that's chewy and that's going to sit nicely next to it. So I might need some crunch. I might want to throw a handful of seeds or, you know, some delicious rye breadcrumbs or something like that on the top. And then the last element is always how it's going to look, because I think there's so much more to being satisfied and sated than just, you know, flavor. So, you know, and in my sort of day job when I was a food stylist, that was obviously a big part. So it'll be just saving a few little elements or adding some herbs or something that just really makes it sing on the plate.
See, it's funny, you think you and your brother think differently, but you just think conversely. Whereas, you know, he'd listen to a song and deconstruct it, and you are the composer that puts it all together. And all these elements are like putting a band together and picking what style and what bandmates you need and instruments.
Absolutely,
and what you want to look like, what venues you want to play. And I only hope that band is called the Modern Eaters. And I expect an album in the next few years.
Yeah, and who's going to be on lead guitar? I mean, these are big decisions.
Excellent. Well, ponder that, and we're going to take a quick break. You've been listening to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. We'll be right back.
Could an app be the answer to a better garden? Absolutely. It's the new free app, Homegrown with Bonnie Plants. Note, track, and photograph your garden's progress. Personalize your weather and reminders. Get variety info, grow guides, hands-free dictation, and more. The Homegrown with Bonnie Plants app, the sharpest tool in your garden. Download it free on the App Store.
Hey, and welcome back to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I'm your host, Michael Harlan-Turkel, here again with Hannah Jones of A Modern Way to Eat. And we were just talking about those visual maps, you know, how to put together a recipe. When you're vegetarian, when you first become vegetarian, there is that quest. It's like a vision quest, but it's to find first and then make the best veggie burger possible. What was that journey like for you?
It was a long one. It was a long one, I've got to say. But I kind of had a bit of a fight with myself, really, about whether or not I wanted to put a veggie burger into my book, because I felt like it was kind of everything that was kind of great if it's good, and everything that was kind of a little bit sort of staid and old-fashioned about vegetarian cooking. But after about 30 or 40 attempts, I came up with something that I felt was so delicious it deserved a place there. And I actually think it's a really important thing to have some dishes that feel really easy and feel really achievable and feel really relatable to people, because for a lot of people, you know, eating, you know, with vegetables is something that's very new and a bit you know, a bit of a leap and a bit confusing. So if you can make that step as easy as possible, then I think a veggie burger is the way. So yeah, for me, it's lots of mushrooms, it's dates, it's tahini, it's all of those kind of layers of flavor which go into my really hungry burger that I that I absolutely dig. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I'm surely going to be making that. You know, I was thinking that there might be nuts in there because when I went over to the UK and, you know, I was vegetarian, no one had anything to serve me. I'd go over to Edgware and eat halloumi sandwiches.
Yeah.
And that was and the limit amazing. Of it. They're fantastic, but you can only survive on so many halloumi sandwiches.
Yeah.
And then there was nut loaf.
Yeah.
Something I had never encountered before and may never encounter again. But what is nut loaf and how do nuts play a big part in this book in your life?
Yeah, well, nut loaf is sort of the generic vegetarian offering in, you know, if you go for a Sunday roast, which is, you know, a British institution, the vegetarian offering will be a nut roast. And I have to say, like, anything in food, they range from deeply diabolical to, you know, amazing. They are loads and loads. They should be loads of delicious roasted caramelized vegetables and onions, then with some amazing nuts mixed together with lovely herbs. So they're like a sort of vegetarian meatloaf, I guess. And they should be a thing of joy. My mom makes an amazing one, but quite often they are deeply lackluster. So, but yeah, nuts in general, I play a huge part in how I eat. I think, you know, whenever I say I don't eat meat, people say, oh, but how do you get your protein? I mean, that's like the major question. And I think that, you know, I don't worry about that too much because I believe that if you cast your net as wide as possible and eat a variation of grains and pulses and nuts and seeds, then you're going to be fine. So it's not like I ever really, really think hard about that. But nuts are something that I incorporate into lots of dishes. I love making kind of all kind of quirky kind of pesto type things and dressings and sauces using nuts. I love making things with cashews. You know, my brother and sister are vegan, so, you know, the old cashew mayonnaise gets whipped up, you know, quite frequently. So they're a big part of how I cook.
Yeah, I mean, there are also all those add-ins to your smoothies, like, what is it, a lucuma, matcha powder, hemp, bee pollen, spirulina.
Yeah.
Everyone thinks of these things as supplements, not as stars. Do they have any inherent flavors to them?
Absolutely, yeah, they really do. And I try never to use anything, you know, either for its purely for its nutritional content or, you know, purely because it's kind of a fatty food. There are, you know, lucuma, or I'm never quite sure exactly how to say it, but that's got a lovely kind of caramelly flavor, and maca almost has like a malty flavor, and actually if they're blended with the right things, they mean that you boost the sweetness of perhaps, like, you know, if you're having a green smoothie, which we all know can be kind of like, you know, jaw clenchingly sort of healthy sometimes, a couple of tablespoons of that, you know, is doing wonders nutritionally, but also on a flavor level is amazing.
Yeah, but you never say to yourself, oh, I'm really craving some spirulina today.
No, I have to say, not so much, but that kind of like greeny kind of chlorophyll flavor of green vegetables I do crave. And it's not spirulina, but it's things like kale, it's things like greens. And, you know, I do crave that some mornings when I have, you know, a juice that's filled with all that lovely green stuff. It does. It peps me up, but also I love the flavor of it. And if you don't love the flavor of it, then, you know, why would you ever? I just don't understand why anyone would eat anything they didn't
agreed.
Love the flavor
of. And, you know, back to the nut loaf, where that, you know, was the vegetarian staple. And then people worry about protein and like, oh, you look a little jaundicey. If you eat worldly, if you eat globally, I never feel like that's true. And what's wonderful is that you have been able to see a lot through your life, through your works. And there are influences of, like, the Turkish fried eggs.
Yeah.
I love fried eggs. But this elevates it, you know, the creaminess of the yogurt and, you know, the herbs and the spices. Elevate this into a dish that not only is transportive, but also just kind of so different from what you're used to and so enlightening at the same time. And I feel like you do the same thing with your dosas. How has travel kind of affected your cooking lexicon?
Yeah, it is affected it hugely. There's definitely some areas of the world that I go back to and I lean on a huge amount. Italy, that I mentioned earlier, you know, I just think they're complete geniuses with vegetables. I love a plate of pasta. And yeah, so I go back there a lot. South India, those kind of coconut, curry leaf, mustard seed flavors. You know, I could eat every meal of the day. You know, incredible vegetarian food when I've traveled through sort of Bali and Indonesia, but also in London, I guess, as sort of, you know, here in New York, it's such a melting pot of flavors. In my, you know, within a 5-minute walk of my house, there's two Turkish shops, you know, about 5 different Asian shops. So I feel even if I don't travel, I'm kind of traveling by just walking down my local market street anyway, which is such a joy.
No, I mean, talk about the pedestrian ingredients in something like gado-gado, you know, or however you say that. Yeah. That Indonesian dish where, of course, is a satay sauce, but if you read everything else that's in it, what is it? Potatoes, tofu, French beans, sugar snap peas, broccoli, bean sprouts, cilantro, shallots, fried shallots at that.
Yeah.
The most important part, fried shallots.
Key.
Nothing seems Indonesian per se.
No. And I think that's the incredible and wonderful, you know, mesmerizing thing about food, which is what got me excited about it in the first place, is that, you know, the pattern and the order in which you put stuff together can, you know, the ingredients can be the same, but the pattern and the order and the delicacy which you handle them with can have, you know, manifold results, which is just, yeah, what keeps me going back into the kitchen.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like it's very true of your galette. It is a seeded galette, I believe. Mm-hmm. What, yeah. Pistachio and squash?
Pistachio, yeah, and sunflower seeds is the base, and then squash, yeah.
Yeah, sometimes I wonder whether or not you're coming from a cooking angle or a styling angle.
Yeah.
But it is such a stunning thing, you know, and for a galette of those kind of elements, you'd think it tend towards the savory, but there are certainly sweet highlights to it too.
I think there are. I think I definitely have a bit of a sweet tooth, and I think that sweet is something that perhaps isn't, you know, incorporated into savory food very much. And that doesn't mean that it's going to, you know, taste like a dessert. But I think in order to balance out, you know, the bitterness sometimes, or the sour, sharp, you know, lemon juice, sometimes you do need a bit of sweetness. And quite often with vegetables, that comes from the natural caramelization and roasting process that happens. So I think, yeah, a lot of my dishes are put together, you know, from a flavor perspective, first and foremost, but also from a perspective of how they're going to look, because, you know, that's such a huge part of how I eat, and I think how we all eat.
And I think that cross-section are honey roasted radishes.
Yes. Yeah, I love those. And actually, they have been, they are the recipe in the book that most people think, oh my God, they're going to be disgusting. I don't like radishes. They're the stuff of my childhood. Or roasting radishes, you're spoiling them. These are a wonderful fresh ingredient, but they are, you know, it completely transforms them into a utterly different thing. And I think that's the amazing, you know, amazing skill of vegetables, the amount of different ways of cooking them, and the, you know, the wonderful ways in which they change.
You have this list of vegetable underdogs.
Yeah.
I almost feel like there should be playing cards, or they're like the bad news bears of this book. But
yeah.
Turnips, chard, celeriac, Jerusalem artichokes, rutabaga. Why are they disliked, and what can we do to like them more?
I think they're disliked just because there's not an understanding of what to do with them. I think once they're cooked, you know, amazingly, people absolutely love them. I make kind of, you know, chips out of turnips or rutabagas. Is that the right term here? You know, with kind of a bit of smoked paprika.
Oh, that's the Swede thing that I learned from April. Swedes
thing.
Are rutabagas.
Rutabagas, yeah. Yeah, Swede chips. Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, with smoked paprika and some smoked sea salt. And, you know, kids absolutely kill for them. People don't actually understand what vegetable it is. So I think there's just a few brilliant kind of cheap and achievable vegetables that, that are getting completely ignored. And I don't know if the same trend is happening here, but in the UK, people are kind of lapping up this whole local veg box thing. So everyone gets delivered a box of vegetables on, you know, a Wednesday or Thursday. And, you know, because of the way the farmers work, there is always, you know, a kohlrabi or a swede or something else in there. So I just really wanted to kind of push these underdogs up to the forefront, get them at the front of the band rather than the backing singers, you know.
It's all about the music. Yeah. I swear, you know, the modern eaters will happen, and I will play bass if you need a bassist.
That'd be amazing.
But these visual maps, again, you not only say, well, here's a recipe for this, but you were talking about the texture of a Swede chip, and now, from now on, rutabagas be damned, they're Swedes. But texture is simply one of the facets that you can kind of change per, but the iterations underneath each of these vegetables in this book is just fascinating. Even kind of composing a salad as well, the kind of analytics that goes behind making such beautiful and creative dishes, I think is what sets this book apart. Because, yeah, you can make a recipe, and I love plenty. I love Ottolenghi's books, but to be able to then make your own recipe and make it as beautiful and as delicious as you want it, you're giving people this tool, which I'm assuming you've learned from many years and many hats.
Absolutely.
But this tool is so empowering.
Yeah. And I think that's what, you know, cooking, that's what recipe books and cooking should be all about, really. It should be about educating people, you know, to a level where recipe books become redundant. You know, wouldn't that be wonderful if people were so informed and so practiced in cooking and so engaged in home cooking that, you know, it would put me out of a job, it would put Ottolenghi out of a job, it would put Jamie Oliver out of a job, but I'm sure they'd be really, really happy about it. And I think that's something that has come from my training with Jamie, is that, you know, it's all well and good to give someone a recipe, but if you don't empower them with, you know, the skills and the confidence to actually, you know, work things out a little bit beyond that, then you're giving them something, you know, that's not very dynamic at all.
Yeah, I don't think anyone would be out of a job, because what I think it does is create this revolution. And obviously, you know from Jamie's work that he has created some revolutions, but you empower somebody with the skill set. I'm going to take Mexican food, because I know you dabble in it, having lived in California,
yeah.
And there isn't that kind of cuisine in the UK. But if you know how to make it and you teach someone else how to make it, there will be a clamoring for that kind of cuisine, that kind of food.
Absolutely.
And then hopefully those restaurants will open.
I am crossing my fingers for that, because London needs some amazing Mexican restaurants. And, you know, there's a taste for it. British people love Mexican food, but unfortunately, the delicacy and the sleight of hand that people have with Mexican cooking here doesn't exist really in the UK. So I think you're right. I think, you know, these recipe books are important to just sow that seed initially and give people ideas, because I think 90% of people probably don't follow a recipe word for word, but they do become inspired, and they do, you know, they do read and hear about new ingredients. And if, you know, the effect is just to make one small change in your diet or to try cooking some Mexican food, then, you know, that's incredible.
Thank you so much for being on. And please get A Modern Way to Eat. And, you know, go for the recipes, but stay for the revolution. You've been listening to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. Hope to have you back here next Tuesday at 3. Cheers.
Thanks for listening to this program on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Heritage_Radio. You can email us with questions anytime at info@HeritageRadioNetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.